For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Well, good morning, Bodhisattvas. Hola, ¿cómo estás? Thank you all for coming together this morning in this place, on the ground and in the cloud, to embody the Buddha Dharma in community. Pretty wonderful. And feels very fresh to me. Because I'm so happy to be sitting here together with you in our Lincoln Square Zendo after spending a month in a tiny town in the Mexican state of Quintana Roo, that's how I heard it's pronounced. So for the past month, I have been exploring the Dharma of vacation. The Dharma of holiday, the Dharma of recreation. And I thought about vacation. What is that? You know, in Zen, sometimes people are like, you're never on vacation.
No.
Because we're always practicing. That's not work. But we actually always are in some kind of vacating. No, I was thinking of vacating. I don't know. Is David Ray? He's not. Is David Ray's here? Mm-hmm. So can you say a little about the Latin root of vacation?
Sure. The verb vacare just means to, like, be free, be available. In Latin, if you say si vaca, if, that just means if you have free time. So it means the same thing as the English vacation.
Yeah. So free. So it's liberated. But we're always liberated, unless we're caught by something. And being in a new place is always a great way to see if you're caught. So I was in this new place, recreating or recreating, where people speak a language that's not my native tongue, and that I speak like a complete fool, where there are different customs and foods, and living with my friends who I don't normally live with. So it had this flavor of monastic practice, actually. You know, we think of monastic practice in the mountains, in the fog, in the, you know, kind of high altitudes, but I was pretty close to sea level and by the ocean on flat land, flat as far as I could see, with mangroves and what is known as jungle around. And still, this heightened sense of newness, of discovering in social interactions as a guest in this country. It's very aware of sort of my privilege and being a guest. And discovering how to manage meals and bathing, you know, in a new place. And uncertainty, not quite knowing what was next. You know, I didn't quite have a schedule. In at least a monastic retreat, you have a schedule. And not always knowing how to proceed. We actually never really know, but there's more certainty when we're in familiar circumstances, I think. During my plane's descent into Cancun Airport, imagine this, you know, this Zen priest with a plane full of revelers who are on their way to like some giant resorts that I've never been to, you know, and I'm sitting there just enjoying the scenery. And as it was descending, there were beautiful white clouds, billowy, puffy clouds and sparkling ocean. And I just felt very grateful for this opportunity to travel. And I thought about so much effort that makes our life and our experiences in this world possible. The beautiful ones and the not so beautiful ones that the whole earth is supporting us at all times, that the great ocean is supporting us, and that so many people who I never will see, and all the beings on the planet. So this is sort of how I wrote. I was, I think other people were thinking about their next margarita, you know. maybe not. I tried to talk to the person next to me, but they clearly also thought I was a weirdo, you know, so I wasn't quite dressed in beach attire. My friends who arrived on a separate flight met me at the airport. And then we found our way back to our little tiny town in the midst. It's really weird that there's some little sanctuary in the midst of all of this amazing greed gone wild, you know, consumer culture that is this area from this part of place, you know, Cancun, which is famous, down to Tulum. You know, it's just, there's this little town with like three streets and they still have local festivals and all that stuff. So we made our way to this dwelling place and I set up shop. And my setting up shop is, first thing I do is I get my rakusu and my altar materials out of the top of my suitcase. Hint, always take your rakusu or your okesas on the plane. Don't pack it away. And keep it with you and try not to lose it. So, but it's great to set up shop. So get into my room in a little house that we had rented. Find a high place, set up my altar with Maitreya Buddha on it, who's my lately been a favorite of mine, this Buddha of kindness and supposedly of the future, but I think the time is now, Bodhisattvas. This is Bodhisattva community. So set Buddha on a high place, put my rakusu and the Dharma book I was studying next to it. And then I started to unpack the rest of my belongings, including my fins and snorkel. And I noticed on my bed, the people who prepare the room had scattered plumeria flowers. I mean, did I land in like some kind of heaven? You know, so I gathered the flowers and put them on the altar. So I'm like, oh, that's very nice. Something to offer Buddha. I did a few standing bows after that. It's really interesting. Of course, my greed took over and I'm like, I wonder if there are more plumeria flowers. No. And actually, plumeria, I don't know if anybody's familiar with plumeria. So Eve, do you know that they sort of like die away after they bloom? They look like some completely barren stem.
Yeah.
So I just maybe gotten the last couple off that plumeria stick outside of the home. So I had to be satisfied with the ones that eventually dried up on my altar, which I was. I could say a lot more about my days in this setting. Maybe I will later. And some of you on Thursday have heard enough of my stories probably by now, my Mexico stories. But suffice to say, as usual, Zazen centered my day. And sometimes I even join the cloud Zendo online. But this morning, I'd like to share something that permeated and inspired my life while I was here on vacation. While I was exploring liberation or emptiness. And this something I can't quite get a hold of, so maybe it'll still be vague after I talk about it. Hopefully it will still be vague after I talk about it. This is something called the Dharma that's been passed along to me. And I just want to offer it to you. So last year, maybe sometime last year, I don't remember when, I received an email from someone who was maintaining a website for our great teacher and my Dharma grandfather and Tigan's transmission teacher, Tenshin Reb Anderson. Someone is making a website for Reb, or he has a website, they were updating it. And this email read, Tenshin Roshi suggested I contact you in regard to a biography for Tayo Lipscomb. I wonder if you'd be willing to write a short biography for Tayo or work with him to create one to be included in our Dharma Successor biography document and linked to the Dharma Successor page on the website. I'm like, Tayo is my teacher. And Tayo was ordained with Tigen. So Reb is their teacher and still alive. And some people, I think, are planning to go to a Sesshin with Reb at some point soon in Brooklyn. But he's a teacher at San Francisco Zen Center. And I thought, I better check with Tayo and see if he's okay with me, what he wants to do about this. And he said, oh, just write something. I don't want to write anything. This is Tayo's style. And I said, well, I actually would like to have a conversation with you about it if it's okay. You know, I kind of wanted to have a conversation so I could get an accurate portrait of my teacher for this few sentences. Just so you could see, this is Tayo. This is Tayo. Tayo. Hi. And I said, how about if I interview you? I'm a psychologist. How about if I interview you? We could do an intake interview. And he's like, okay, yeah. Because I usually don't talk that much about myself. I said, I know, but I think I'd like to get a few things straight. Like when you came to San Francisco Zen Center, for instance. I was like, okay. And you can see this biography. And Tigen, of course, has a biography. And Galen, who spoke here a few weeks ago, also. So you can go on Tenshin Roshi's website and look up the biographies of his Dharma successors, the people who received Dharma transmission from him. And I was thinking about, well, what's received? What are we connected to? What are we offering each other in this practice? And so in the course of my conversation with Tayo, many conversations, as a matter of fact, we haven't really finished. I wrote the bio, but Tayo and I are still talking about this same topic of his life. And I said, well, how did you come to Zen, to practice? And he said he'd been kind of lost, living a hippie lifestyle in the Bay Area in the early 70s, after, by the way, being in the Vietnam War. I think he came back from that experience off kilter, understandably. And a roommate randomly suggested that they take a camping trip. You know, he was out of sorts, and his roommate was like, you know, a bunch of hippies lived in a house in the Bay Area. And they're like, yeah, let's go camping. So off they would go, probably in some kind of VW bus or bug and some vehicle. And they end up at China Camp in Los Padres National Forest near Tassajara, which is a monastery in San Francisco Zen Center. And some of you, quite a few people in this room have been to Tassajara. Who's been to Tassajara? And online too. And by this room, I mean this whole room. So a bunch of us here have actually know this place, but they were camping down the road and his, and Deborah's been there. They were camping and decided the friend knew about Tassajara and said, let's go to Tassajara. And he's like, what's that place? I don't know. Should we go? And yeah, they've got baths there and a bunch of monks. So they went. And Tayo said, after being there for like a very brief period of time, maybe not even a whole day, he said, I just walked right into the office and said, what is this place? How can I live here? And then stayed for 26 years. And I think this teaching, what is this place and how can I live here, is what is handed down to us, a way to develop an awareness and in some ways learn to be who we are in this moment, in this time, in this exact place, how to live. And this is our way in Zen, in Soto Zen, of discovering every place as a new place. So Mexico wasn't just a new place, had different features maybe, but every moment is, what is this place? What is this place? This beautiful place. And how can I live here? In a way, he didn't say more, but I'll say in parentheses, in a way that honors everything, in a way that cares for everything, in a way that has certain features, which I'll say a little more about. Somehow this teaching of inquiring and responding, Douglas is going to be off to watch a Shuso ceremony upstairs. Thanks, Douglas. I hope you get to ask a question to John Boss. That's all part of our Dharma family in New Orleans. And so this teaching and these conversations of Tayo came up with me to me during my time in Mexico almost every day. What is this place? How can I live here? And it's maybe the question for most of us in some ways, at least it's a question for me. And it helped me remember my first meeting of Tayo, just seeing him move around. We met in 1988. So really he hadn't been practicing that long, maybe 13 years, you know, living in San Francisco Zen Center settings. A lot of that time at Tassajara and later at Green Gulch, but also in the city. And I saw how he was meeting people in the situation kind of wordlessly in kind of a crazy situation I met him in. And I said, oh, I want to live this way. I want to do what this person does. So I just asked him for instruction in that. And he said, well, let me give you instruction in Zazen. We were on some kind of camping situation, actually, ourselves at that time. And he would sit in his tent, and I'd sit in my tent, little North Face, like, pop-up tent in the morning. And I can't exactly say what I noticed, or I don't know exactly what Tayo noticed at Tassajara, but it has something to do with what we call practice realization, or expressing what we really know, is the right, the upright way to live in community with all beings. I think that's part of what draws us here. We know that maybe we're off kilter a little bit, but we recognize or we see or we know something that can't be expressed that we still want to express. Can't be expressed by force. This way, this upright way in community with all beings is kind and patient, open, flexible, natural. It's simple. It's direct. It's authentic. And we know when it's not. We know when we behave in a way that's not authentic. It doesn't feel right. Our bodies don't feel right. I could feel that in Mexico when at first I wasn't used to everybody looking me in the face going, hola, ¿cómo estás? You know, here we're like this in the city. You turn away. But there, you know, and they don't just stop at hello or hey. Everybody's like, ¿cómo estás? Or ¿qué tal? ¿Qué pasa? You know, so, and how to respond to that. People were often shocked when I responded because they're not used to white North Americans responding. Even inquiring a little more, like, yeah, I'm okay. How about you? And, but I could feel at first there was this resistance, like conditioning, holding me back. But then that moment of connection can change everything, you know. So much conditioning we have as humans, habits of contraction, we might say, that hold us back. But a moment of connection with a teacher, with the earth, with a phrase, with what we call the Buddha Dharma, points the way. You don't know where it's pointing, where it, you know, there's not a map attached to the finger, but there's some pointing of the way. And there's trust involved with this. That trust is kind of surrender. So I tried to remember this way, you know, when I met the life of this tiny vision village of Puerto Morelos, Mexico, in the tropical landscape with bird calls that I didn't know. There were fewer birds than there had been in the past, at least by my Merlin bird identifier. It was a tiny owl living in a hollowed out hole in a tree across the way. I tried to remember this when I swam and coursed and snorkeled in the Caribbean Ocean with its dying reef. It is dying. And with the people we met who saw this great boom in commercialism in their area as a godsend. And I kind of saw it as a landfill. Both were probably correct. I've tried to remember this sense of what is this? How do I live here? What is this in coffee? I was drinking coffee. My friends were drinking mate. My friend and her husband, they share the same straw drinking mate. That's the normal way. And they're always like pointing it to me going, do you want some of this? I'm like, not really, sorry. It was rude. I apologize for it. I said, I'm sharing most things with you, but that straw is not it for me. Maybe next time. Maybe next time. This way of what is this place and how do I live here? You know, this way is also in relationship. So we're always in relationship and this is the only way we are actually living all the time. And our way, our dragon way, our beautiful ancient dragon way is to help each other. Ask these questions and find our way together and encourage us in this way of expressing our life energy. fully and in some kind of harmony with the almost unbelievable amount of disharmony. You know, I met someone on this trip who lives in this area, and she's a Mexican woman, and she sells like bits of like vacation time. It's not really timeshare, but kind of like a vacation time at this mega resort that's like almost like a Trump Tower, you know, like everything's really gold plated and you get all the food and drink you can possibly want. And she said, we're selling $1 million per day. $1 million per day. I thought, Ancient Dragon could just use one day of that and we'd be set. I wonder how I can get in on this deal. You know? she had like a couple really cute, like high-end designer items, which were gifts, you know, for her sales expertise. But maybe I should learn something from her. But how to live in harmony with that. And this way isn't unique to me and my little trip or my experience with my kind teacher over decades now. This extends back to Shakyamuni Buddha and how he related to their students and the people he met. And here's a little story, well-known story at Ancient Dragon, you could say, that extends back to our great Chinese ancestor and founder of our school, who Taigen has written a lot about, and we'll probably have plenty to comment about this little story. But when Dongshan, long ago in China, was leaving his teacher, just before leaving, he said, if after many years, someone should ask if I'm able to portray your likeness, your portrait, how should I respond? And Yunyan remained quiet for a little while and said, just this person. Just this. Just this. Just this person. And Dongshan wasn't maybe paying a lot of attention or didn't know what this meant and was lost in thought. Going, what? Just this person? Just this? Now, this is famous for us now, but for then it sounded kind of new. This could be new for us in every moment, too. And Yunyan said, listen, having assumed the burden of the teachings of Buddha, protecting and offering them, you must be very cautious. And Dongshan remained dubious about what Yunyan had said. Did you ever have that happen? You talk to some Zen person, a teacher, they say something and they're acting like it's profound and you're like, I know what you're talking about. Or I'm not quite sure what you mean, but you're too scared to say, hey, tell me more about what you meant. Like it took me, you know, almost 30 years to ask my teacher, tell me a little bit more about what you meant in your life, what practice meant to you. Later, Dongshan was crossing a river and he saw his image reflected and experienced a great awakening about the meaning of this intimate exchange with his teacher that he kind of maybe didn't even realize how intimate it was at the time. His little gatha, his little verse, this is a verse of Dongshan, earnestly avoid seeking without, lest it recede far from you. Today, I'm walking alone. Yet everywhere I meet him, meet my teacher, meet the teaching of the Buddha Dharma, meet suchness, meet emptiness, meet someone selling $1 million a day of a hotel. That would freak me out. Everywhere I meet him, he is now no other than myself. But I am not now him. What does that mean? It must be understood in this way in order to merge with suchness, in order to be one. One more story. The husband of this woman who was selling all this stuff said to me, "Did you ever hear about this poison from a toad that you smoke? I smoked some of this and it was amazing. I took one puff, laid back, and I let go of my ego completely." I said, "And then what?" He said, "Well, I felt something." I said, "Like oneness?" He goes, "Yes, oneness." And I said, "Yeah. I wonder, I've had that feeling too, and I always wonder, what's that mean for my life? What is this place? How do I live here?" So that's my little story. I don't know if they're going to pull the plug on me yet. I think this is about time. I've got about 10 minutes for discussion, I think. Does that sound right? Keep me on track, Bodhisattvas. I will say, in closing, that in Red Pine's translations of the teachings of Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen, right? So this is an Indian now. This is how far this goes back. Says, if you don't find a teacher soon, you'll live this life in vain. It's true you have Buddha nature, but without the help of a teacher, you'll never know it. Only one person in a million becomes enlightened without a teacher's help. So I feel grateful, and my teacher teaches me continuously and is no longer just restricted to this person known as Tayo. Yet, that echo, I keep hearing that echo. What is this place? How do I live here? So thank you very much. It's really wonderful to see everyone and share this practice together. And any comments or elaborations or wisdom you'd like to share with us? And I think our techno, Bodhisattva will will help us with people online if I don't see you. Mm-hmm. And also anybody else, just flag me down if you need to be recognized to speak. How do you approach your vacations?
I feel like I asked that question, you know, what is this place, how do I live here, or how do we live here, as time goes on and, you know, we move into what we used to think of as the future, and we've got climate change, and we've still got war, and we've got 8 billion people, and so I keep asking that question, what is this place, how do we live here?
Yeah, so Eve asked this question in the midst of, just to repeat it a little bit, what is this place? How do we live? How do we live here? You know, and some of it is your place in the midst of war and climate change and all the horrors. There is that. How do we live? And then how do we live in this moment, in this space right now? And everybody has to find their own answer. But we have some help from the Buddha Dharma. There's a gigantic amount of writings, but there is the Eightfold Path, there are the precepts and the paramitas. So we have a lot of help if we think we need some consultation. And we also have teachers, which can help us in some ways, or at least just noticed I was slightly canted to one side. Help us kind of find a little balance in the midst of that. So thank you, Eve. I sense that you ask that question continuously with your inquisitive mind.
Deborah has her hand up.
Deborah. Hello, Deborah Bodhisattva. I haven't seen you for a while.
Yes, I just wanted to thank you for sharing how you arrived in Mexico and immediately did those steps of, you know, setting up your altar and connecting to the flowers. And I felt it answers Eve's question, how do I live here? You know, just that you take the practice with you and manifest it. I just was really grateful for your words on that. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, in the sutras, they say things like, you know, flowers rain down on the great assembly. And I'm like, what? What's going on? I remember years ago traveling in Thailand, and I found a garland of jasmine in my room that bloomed at night. The garland, the flowers were still blooming for like a week. I don't know how they did that. But, you know, there are, in the midst of the horror in this world, there are also like these kind of amazing Dharma flowers everywhere. And to encompass all that, or to leave room, leave space and openness to all that, kind of comforting for me. It's kind of comforting. Michael Bodhisattva, I haven't seen you for a while either.
I have a question about the impulse to become a teacher while learning. For just you.
For me?
Yeah.
So Michael, for those online, just in case you didn't hear, asked about the impulse to become a teacher while learning. For me, I don't know if I ever had an impulse. Almost the opposite. It's just people keep asking me to do stuff. You know, it's like, oh, can you be on the serving crew? Can you clean this bathroom? Can you, you know, fix up the altar, dust it? And all of a sudden it's like, you know, times like, can you give a Dharma talk? So I'm always learning. And I think that maybe the ability or the teaching comes from getting out of the way of that learning and learning from everyone. You know, all of you, many of you have known me a long time and hopefully will know me a long time. And we grow and change and learn together. And so I feel like I just kind of give back what's been given to me. My teacher would never say he's a teacher. When I said, can you be my teacher? He said, well, I can be your Dharma friend. How's that? He doesn't like giving Dharma talks. Yet, when we have dinner together, when we do recycling together, when we're talking in conversation about life. But, you know, somehow we end up in certain places, certain locations. But I think the more I can be open to learning in every moment, then it's not me teaching. But if I get too attached to teaching, or if that impulse is a grasping or rejecting even impulse, take my stick and hit me in the nose. Boop. Not too hard. So thank you for that question, and I will continue with it, hopefully. My buddy side that.
This question reminded me of how intertwined learning and teaching are. Etymologically, the word learn comes from the word to teach. And there are like many aphorisms in English, like I'll learn you, or I'll learn you. I'm always reminded how learning is teaching and teaching is learning, and how that sentiment is in and of itself. And if we're open to seeing that in whatever situations we encounter, it helps. Like, if I have to teach something, someone has to teach something, it can cause anxiety. Mm-hmm. Or if I'm not good enough, I know what I know. And, you know, it's like you said, you learn to do a thing, you know, you get asked to do a thing, and then you share that. And that's learning and teaching.
Even though you don't know anything.
Yeah.
And what gets in the way is like, oh, I can't teach you because I'm not good enough. That's like a block. Because it's like I hold back. You said something about an ENSO in there, didn't you?
No.
You didn't. I thought I misheard it. I had an auditory hallucination. But I was thinking about this as an ENSO, as a great circle that we share. And in some ways, I think about these teachings and this lineage, going back to Buddha, what is this place? How can I live here? It's not like I've got this and I'm giving it to you, but there's sort of a gentle passing along, you know, of a flame of the Dharma, you know, maybe a flame, and tending it. But at the same time, you have to be careful with flames, you know. Anything else? Are we complete, Bodhisattvas? So I think what will happen now, that was kind of sweet. Terry had her foot on my sleeve. And it felt like just kind of a soft little tug. That's how intimate we are in this tiny, humble sendo.